Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking with one of the three authors of The Great Broadening, How the Vast Expansion of the Policymaking Agenda Transformed American Politics. The book is published this year, very recently, by the University of Chicago Press. The three authors, Brian Jones, Sean Terrio, and Michelle Wyman, have written this big, significant book. I have Brian Jones on the phone right now. Brian, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Heath. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for sharing the book and agreeing to talk about it. It's big in so many ways. There's so much in the book. Before we get to that, maybe you can just briefly introduce yourself and also the co-authors on this project.
Sure. Brian Jones. I'm the J.J. Jake Pickle Chair, Regents Chair in Congressional Studies at the University of Texas in Austin. My colleague is our Sean Thirio, who is a professor at the Department of Government in UT Austin, and Michelle Wyman, one of our former graduate students, now an assistant professor at Florida State. So the collaboration came about when Michelle and I began talking about some of these ideas that had struck me as interesting over the years from our work in the policy agendas with the policy agendas project, the U.S. Policy Agendas Project, which was established some years ago by Frank Baumgartner and myself. And now we have long-time series of policy making in the U.S. and other countries too, because we have a comparative focus on that and comparativeagendasprojects.net will get you to those data sets. So these data sets could be exploited over a period of time since the Second World War, and that's what started our thinking on this. Go ahead.
Yeah, no. The data in this is so interesting, and the historical span, I think, is what makes the book such a major contribution. If in reading the book, it seems to me that it's really divided into three parts. That is the period before about 1960, the period between about 1960 and about 1980, and the period after. I wonder, is this the right reading of the chronology of the story you tell in the book? And if so, you know, what characterized the government in the U.S. in the earliest of period, but before much of the story goes on here? And then we'll talk about the actual, like, kind of the meat of the story here. But is this about the right setup?
Yeah, it is. And I'll go into a little more detail, but not too much. One, I felt for a long time we need to integrate ourselves with history a little bit better, but not always with only qualitative analyses, but also with quantitative analyses, which is the Great Broadening uses, but at mostly a descriptive level, that is simple graphs. But the three periods before, during, and after, the period we call the Great Broadening, is a period from about 1958 to 1978, in which the government moved into so many more new areas of activity that it had not been in before. And I mean, the federal government. It moved into areas previously occupied by mostly the private sector and citizens alone, and it moved into areas previously occupied by state and local governments. And this period was a very quick broadening of government. We call it broadening because it doesn't show up much in expenditure measures, but it sure shows up in the policy agendas measures we use, which is basically the number of issues that are invaded, or I don't want to use that word, but occupied by the federal government that were not occupied before. And in the description of these periods, we find lower activity during the period before that, and then this increased activity. After that period, we find two patterns, depending on the data set we're working with. Sometimes the data sets tail off. There's less activity. For example, in lawmaking, there's a lot less lawmaking on a lot fewer subjects after about 1980, as you say, really 1978. And other measures, though, stay high. Once they get there, they stay high, and those issues continue to be worked on by the federal government. For example, hearings in Congress that are not related to lawmaking stay up because these bureaucracies have been built, and Congress needs to oversee these bureaucracies, and it has continued to do so. So we find these two different patterns. One's an arc. And they show up very clearly in the graphs we show in the book. And the other is a plateau, which plateaus out and stays active throughout the period.
So if we accept that there has been this broadening, and we can talk more about some of the different ways that you measure this. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of, if we accept this, you credit in the book, you and your co-authors credit a lot of this to the influence of social movements. Now, this is different than much of the past scholarship on the kind of the broad topic. I wonder how you explain the causal story of the impact of social movements on this great broadening, and also which were the most important social movements at play here?
Those are great questions. One, we got into this because it just did not look like the standard interpretations would do a very good job of explaining the totality of the broadening period. For example, we looked at things like public opinion and party changes and interest groups and things like that might have accounted for these changes. None of them are, all of them seem important with the possible exception of interest groups. Certainly public opinion and parties are important, but it didn't seem complete, and you couldn't account for the amount of broadening by what parties are doing, partly because the broadening continued when parties changed. So we began to look more deeply at this and found the explanation, we think, in social movements. And the social movements included, most importantly, civil rights, movement for Black rights, the war in Vietnam, which does not show up in our broadening measures, but it's important because it was a major social movement of the time. The reason it doesn't show up in the broadening measures is because Vietnam War would have fallen under the military power, which are well established across history. And women's rights, environmentalism, and consumerism. We see those as the major disruptors in the period. Now, these social movements learn from each other. The laws established governing systems for these policy subsystems, as we call them, and locked in much of that great broadening period. Now, we do not claim that the social movements explain everything because parties are important, public opinion is important, leadership is important. Yes, yes, yes. What we do say is we've really underestimated the importance of social movements on public policy in the study of political science, and it's time we rectify that. Maybe we're wrong. Show us that we are. Because we don't have faith that this is the complete explanation, but it sure seemed like an important part of the explanation of the Great Broadening.
So a lot of your study is, as you have alluded to so far, is about agenda setting and the importance of understanding the dynamics of agenda setting for issue legitimacy, and also for setting a path forward on government action. So there's this path dependence that runs throughout the book. And in chapter 4, you examine the number of new issues that are added to the congressional agenda from the early period in the 1940s up through the 2000s or so. What is the pattern that you discover? And why does it matter so much to understand the new issues that Congress takes on, not just the overall size growth. What is it about the new things that are added that is so important? And do they stay on the agenda, or are they new and then disappear?
Well, there's a mix, but a lot of them stay on the agenda. And this is really the most important part of what I think we found. And I think we nailed it much better than some of the other elements. Raising questions in a book, by the way, is as important as answering them. And we don't claim to have answered them all. But in the case of measuring these new issues and how they were treated in the Great Broadening, turns out when the issues emerge and people begin to see them as problems, they don't fall along party lines very well. They don't fall along ideological lines very well. So the parties struggle with how to define them in terms of the party identifications that people have. Well, I mean, so we think today of environmentalism and women's rights and civil rights as all being the province of the Democratic Party. Boy, that wasn't true in the Great Broadening. The parties were split on civil rights, with the Democrats being split between the segregationist wing and the labor liberal wing. The Republicans were split by those who were more ideologically conservative and those that wanted to reach out to the civil rights community and remembered themselves as the party of Lincoln. About 40% of blacks voted for President Eisenhower in 1956, the Republican candidate. So there was no consensus there. Similarly, as Christine Woolbrick has shown, the women's rights movement was divided, more upper middle class concern than working class concerns among laborites. And similarly with environmentalism, which was certainly a province of the Republican Party at the time, because it Nixon took it on head on and dealt with it. So it took a long time for the parties to polarize around these issues. We can see some new issues hitting the agenda now that do that the same thing to the parties. For example, cybersecurity, where privacy and privacy rights and national security conflict, and the parties haven't found good positions on those. So there was a lot of innovation, partly because the parties had not locked in issue definitions. And we show that. In fact, party polarization starts rising after the Great Broadening, not during it, when all this conflict was going on. So it was an innovative period, partly because the issues were new and the politicians hadn't figured out how to define themselves on them.
Can we stay on that point just for a second? Because I think a lot of people would assume that this is a story of polarization, and that the polarization phenomenon is what pushed these dynamics ahead. You find something different in the book, if not necessarily to refute that, at least to make the story much more complicated. So what is the ordering here? Does polarization precede the Great Broadening, or is the Great Broadening starting before the polarization dynamic, that is, the increasing polarization dynamic sets in?
Yeah, during this period, politics were less polarized during the Great Broadening period for reasons that I set out. And as a matter of fact, you can see from our analysis that polarization took place afterwards. We can't say exactly what the causes are, but we can say that polarization did not cause the Great Broadening. That is, it wasn't one party taking on a bunch of big ideas and then jamming them through the electoral system. That's not the way it worked. It worked through a lot of compromise and adjustment and leadership and decentralization. All of those things were going on at once that caused this innovation. And they resulted in polarization later on as the parties figured out how they might appeal to their constituencies based on these things. So over time, the civil rights issue became increasingly associated with the Democrats, and Republicans were increasingly associated with the attempts to limit civil rights activity. And similarly with environmentalism, today we have an anti-environmental Republican administration and Democrats all in on the issue. There are other issues that have done that, but there were so many concentrated in that brief period of time. So you can see that polarization was actually a consequence of the Great Broadening, because as the government moved into so many more areas, it gave the Conservative Party the opportunity to legitimately say, you're moving in all these areas, you don't know what you're doing, you're interfering with people's lives, and you have a conservative reaction to it. That conservative reaction leads later on, very quickly actually, to increases in polarization. Just one finding that will, I hope, provoke some thought among political scientists. There's an idea that everything, the party system, stemmed from the realignment of the South as it went from being mostly Democratic to mostly Republican. And that's certainly true. But the early Republicans elected from the South were no more conservative than their Northern counterparts. Their conservatism scores, their polarization scores, DW nominate scores, as we say into technical lingo of political science, were no different from the Northern colleagues. It was only later that the whole party moved. And once again, Southerners are a little more conservative, but not terribly so. So it was not some regional domination that spread to the rest of the nation. Or at least the story is much more complicated and involves the policies themselves, which my colleagues who study parties and opinions seem to forget sometimes.
Now, the conservative social movement or movements are also integral to understanding the third period in your study and the shift in the trajectory of many of your variables. You described this as a curve rather than a straight line to illustrate this. How has the conservative movement played a part in the great shifts in the breadth and depth of the federal government? From a distance, we would assume they'd be in great opposition to it. But what do you observe in the data about this later time period, the period of 1978, 1980 onward in the broadening? Does the broadening come to a halt and remain at that point, or is it the trajectory changed in some other way?
Well, pretty much came to a halt the way we can measure it during that period. And you can see some elements occasionally from new issues coming online and getting adopted by government since then, but they're very rare. Yes, the conservative counter movement began with a unit. Interestingly, late in the Great Broadening, we had a move toward deregulation. We had regulated lots of industries during the Great Depression, where government had to take control. But there was two elements that became controversial. One was price regulation, where, for example, the government set airline prices and routes, and railroads, which are still a little bit that way. Trucking, all of these industries were very heavily regulated, but they're also regulated increasingly on questions of safety and services that they would be responsible for. So Republicans and Democrats agreed, both Carter in this case, President Carter, and later President Ford, agreed on deregulation. Both agreed on the deregulation of prices. Carter was in favor of continuing safety regulation. Ford wanted to limit some of that. So at first you got this consensus on this. Then the deregulation movement, it was an important movement that led to a lot of consensus on the issue. But after that, it broke down. So you have the Republican Party moving more into, we have Phyllis Schlafly with the conservative women's movement. We don't want the Equal Rights Amendment. It had become an important topic then, and she was able to mobilize conservative women to stop it. So she's a Republican, so it becomes associated with the Republican Party. So anti-regulation, more conservative on the women's movement. The South had become more conservative. The white South had become conservative on the civil rights issue. So these are the kinds of pushbacks that happened. And in the Reagan era, we got the pushback on crime. Crime had become a real problem, and government wasn't doing a very good job of addressing it. And Reagan took advantage of that, dragged the Democrats along with him. So you had a conservative move in that direction, although it added to government, didn't subtract from it, because they added lots of ways in which you could put people in jail. So the conservative reaction was very important, and it's carrying through to this day. The question is it over? Have we gone through that period of time as we did in the Great Broadening period. I don't know that, but there are some elements of that. So you can use some of the analyses we did in the Great Broadening, bring them forward and say, does this kind of work today with systems sort of wearing themselves out by over-success? I don't know. It's a possibility, though.
Now, one of the most interesting parts of the book is towards the end, where you examine the consequences of the Great Broadening. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the longer-term impacts in terms of the administrative state and also the work of Congress as a legislative body or something that has been transformed by the Great Broadening.
Yeah, we started this project wanting to focus on the consequences, but it turned out that reviewers didn't care for that alone, and so we built up the try to understand the causes too, and that's one reason it became so comprehensive. I hope it's fairly pithy, but it is, or at least direct, but it was built on the idea of these policy explosion had great consequences. And we already talked about the polarization consequence. Another consequence was the growth of interest group system. Interest groups less caused policies and more were reactions to them. So the interest group system grew very quickly after the Great Broadening. The administrative state was built up. We had a lot more regulations and rules from the administrative state, as we show in the book, because the government was in a lot of new areas and had to develop new rules and regulations and laws to regulate what they moved into, what the government had moved into. We mentioned Congress. So Congress during the period of the Great Broadening, most of its activity was directed at lawmaking. And we still teach our students that. That's just not right. Congress is mostly an oversight body in which it holds hearings to try to hold the executive branch accountable. And we show that, too, in the book, that, in fact, congressional scholars need to begin to rethink the role of oversight versus the role of lawmaking in the legislative branch of the United States. So all of these things are consequences of this vast expansion. And it seems so sensible now. That is, you got a lot bigger government. You better oversee it. You got an out of control executive branch. And that's part of Congress's responsibility now. About 10% of hearings today are on laws and all the rest about oversight.
The big title is The Great Broadening, How the Vast Expansion of the Policymaking Agenda Transformed American Politics. You've been hearing from Brian Jones. The book is published by University of Chicago Press and says so much about where we've been and where we're heading. Brian, thank you very much for your time today.
It's a real pleasure, Heath. And thank you so much for having me.